Welcome to Too Close to Home, the series where we dig up creepy stories, haunted places and mysteries from our very own Patreons' hometowns. This episode we're looking at Shauna, Carly, Guy, Jordan and Judy. And do we have some good stories in store for you five in this creepy marathon month edition of Too Close to Home? Remember everyone, if you want us to dig up stories from your area, then head on over to Patreon and join our Too Close to Home tier. Not only will we feature your hometown on an episode, you'll also get access to all of our exclusive documentaries over on Patreon. Thank you so much everyone for supporting. And now, this is a special shout out to Shauna, Carly, Guy, Jordan, and Judy to hit those lights, sit back, and enjoy. Ballymun, Dublin. Ballymun is an outer suburb of Dublin, Ireland. Over the years, the area has built up, although some of the houses are reputedly built on an old burial site, and has its fair share of paranormal stories. Our patron Shauna, who lives there, has asked us to share her personal experience of the area, which we would love to do. From the age of 9 to 11, Shauna remembers strange things happening in the house she lived in with her family. Her first memory was when the TV remote flew off the coffee table and her brother's action men were thrown around the room by an unseen force. Shauna shared a room with her older sister, and her sister started complaining of something touching her hand at night, and she thought it was Shauna, but it wasn't. Another incident happened when Shauna was having a shower. The window blind kept going up and down by itself, and the shower started turning off and on. The incident scared her so much that she ran out and hid behind her mother. Another terrifying incident in the bathroom happened when Shauna was washing her hair. She glanced in the mirror and saw the reflection of a figure behind her. She quickly turned around, and stood there was a spectre with no head, wearing a long black coat. When she glanced again, it was gone. Shauna discussed the incident with her sister and was shocked to hear that she had seen the same figure in the coal shed that had recently been taken down. Shortly after the figure incident, the family moved, but Shauna's uncle returned to the house a year or so later to do some painting for the new tenants, and they told him of similar things happening to them in the house. When Shauna was older, she discussed with her mum what had happened, and her mum told her that she used to see things moving and being thrown about all the time in the house, but did not believe whatever it was malicious in any way. I wonder who lives there now, and if they could share some paranormal stories. For our next location, we're moving a few miles away to Glasnevin Cemetery, a place where over 1.5 million bodies are buried. From its unique beginnings when it was once a resting place for both Catholics and Protestants, it is now open to those of every Christian denomination. The first person to be buried there was an 11-year-old child named Michael Kerry, who died of TB on the 22nd of February 1832. It is also the last resting place of hundreds of victims of the cholera outbreak in the 1830s and 40s, whose bodies were unceremoniously buried in pits together. And for children, Glasnevin has a special area known as the Angel's Plot. Over the years, many of the major players in Ireland's political reformation were interred in Glasnevin, as well as many of Ireland's finest and most internationally renowned artists. In 1981, the Irish writer and painter Christy Brown was buried there, and he was famous for his ability to write and type with toes on one foot after being born with cerebral palsy, and his autobiography, My Left Foot, was made into a film of the same name, starring Daniel Day-Lewis, that won multiple Academy Awards. So it has quite a history, along with more than one ghost that haunts its sprawling pathways. One of the more well-known ones is not a human, but a dog. In 1861, Northern Irish Royal Navy Captain John McNeill Boyd went down with his ship, HMS Ajax. His dog, a huge black Newfoundland, was so beside itself with grief that when Boyd was buried in Glasnevin, the dog stayed by the graveside, refusing to eat or sleep. Eventually, the poor creature starved to death. Up until this day, visitors to the cemetery report seeing the loyal dog resting peacefully on Boyd's grave. Another story tells of a nearby cavernous pub, an establishment located so close to the graveyard, it became a place mourners often visit to raise a pint of Guinness in honor of the deceased. Nicknamed the Gravedigger's Pub, it is known for its paranormal activity, and many visitors have described seeing an older gentleman dressed in vintage tweed who sits in a corner quietly and drinks a pint. When he finishes his drink, he's been known to vanish in the blink of an eye. When they share what they have seen with staff members, they've been advised to buy the amiable but unknown spirit a pint for the road. Anne and Carly. Our valued patron Anne has asked us to look at the hometown of her new daughter-in-law, Carly, who is from Richardson, Texas. Carly and Anne's sons are expecting twins, so we'd like to wish them both well. For Carly, we will start with the sad case of Paul Hertel. Paul was a respected citizen in Richardson, Texas. He was a semi-retired electrical engineer, an active community leader, and a devoted husband and father. However, as he left his house on the 13th of August 1996, he was shot in the head and chest at point-blank range. The prime suspect in the brutal murder was Paul's 34-year-old son-in-law, David Thompson. Thompson was married to Paul's daughter, Suzanne. However, the marriage turned violent after David showed a dark, jealous streak. Things got no better after the couple had their first child. And it got so bad, Susan feared for her new baby's life and left David and moved back in with her parents. Divorce proceedings followed, and Susan was awarded temporary custody of their child. David was clearly unhappy with just visitation rights, and in 1993 he abducted his son and left Susan a letter stating that she wouldn't see him again until he was 17 years old. For 10 months there was no sign of David and the child. However, on June 23, 1994, David was arrested and mother and child were reunited. David was stripped of all visitation rights and given 10 years probation. However, Paul was not convinced David would stay away and feared something else would happen. And sadly, he was right, and he was the victim. On the day of Paul's funeral, the family received a letter from David saying he was sorry and he was going to kill himself. No one believed that, and evidence showed David was still alive, possibly sleeping on campsites. 4 months after Paul's death, David was arrested for burglary in San Diego, California. He was convicted and sentenced to 1 year in prison. He had given a false name, and it was only after a match of Thompson's prints that they realized they had a murder suspect in custody. However, remarkably, the case against David was no build, meaning there was not enough evidence to charge him with murder. He did serve 4 years in prison for violating probation, but today is a free man, and the case remains open. The Old Murdoch Cabin. This next one has earned a bit of a reputation in paranormal circles, although we're not sure it's true. The old Murdoch cabin is allegedly situated near a number of high-intensity electrical towers, and is difficult to find unless you are aware of the layout of Richardson. The building is a ramshackle two-room cabin amongst a number of deserted cabins dotting the Texas hills. Over the years, the structure has been condemned several times, and was even set on fire. And today, all that is left is a burned-out shell over a collapsed cellar. However, that hasn't stopped ghost hunters being drawn to the area in search of the elusive cabin, mainly due to events that happened in 2006, when police supposedly found two bodies at the site, that of Corrine Russell, an alleged suicide victim, and Jill Tisdale, a reported accident. The haunted aspect of the cabin has also been fueled by Harry Spengler and Edward Zedmore, who created Hellhound's Lair, a website for paranormal research where they claimed that they have visited Murdoch Cabin and documented so-called proof of ghostly apparitions and poltergeist activity. Other paranormal investigators have jumped on the bandwagon, claiming to have found evidence of demonic worship, as well as shadowy figures lurking in the cellar and electromagnetic equipment that goes off the scale. An earlier story tells of a group of deer hunters who in 1984 sheltered in the cabin during a rainstorm. After discovering preserved food inside, they lit the fire and settled in for the night. But during the evening, they became aware of something or something moving in the cellar beneath them. As the footsteps got nearer, the three men ran for their lives. However, one of them, a police officer, returned the next day to pick up belongings he had left. And after hearing what happened, his colleagues in the force investigated, believing it may have been a gang member who had escaped into the area after shooting a police officer. They found nothing, but apparently the report is still on the file of the Texas State Police. Following the incident, teenagers were drawn to the cabin, going out there on a dare to see the ghosts and getting scared of sounds and shadows. It was these tales that eventually drew Corrine Russell and three of her peers to the Murdoch cabin after discovering and reading about it on the Hellhound's Lair website, resulting in the death of Corrine, who was allegedly found hanging from the rafters. And in similar circumstances, 2 months later, Jill Tisdale suffered a similar fate. In recent years, it is Jill who allegedly haunts the ruins of the cabin after a ghost hunter took a photograph that on closer inspection revealed the huddled body and face of Jill Tisdale staring out in terror from the back of an empty closet. It is hard to tell whether the Murdoch cabin ever exists, but perhaps you could enlighten us, Carly. Chelmsford, England. With settlements dating back to the Neolithic and Bronze Ages, Chelmsford has a vast back catalogue. It has seen Roman occupation, the execution of the ringleaders of the Peasants' Revolt, and the Essex Witch Trials, and a lot of the grisly history of England took place in Chelmsford. It is also the home of our much-valued patron Guy. For you, Guy, first we're going back a bit to 1850, to the sad case of the last woman to be hung for attempted murder in England. On May 16, 1850, 43-year-old farm labourer Richard Chessman died after a long illness in Clavering, Essex. The doctor attributed his death to tuberculosis. However, because Richard had also suffered from bouts of stomach cramps and sickness, the police were suspicious and ordered an autopsy. With the investigation ongoing, rumours started to spread that Richard's wife Sarah was responsible for his death. Sarah already had a reputation as a poisoner and was nicknamed Sally Arsenic, after her two sons, 8-year-old James and 10-year-old Joseph, died 5 years earlier. The two boys' cause of death was officially cholera, but after another young lad died in suspicious circumstances, their bodies were exhumed and small amounts of arsenic was found in their system. Sarah was charged with killing the boys, but later acquitted due to lack of evidence. However, the name stuck, and so did the accusations. And again, Sarah found herself in the dock, accused of murdering her husband, despite little evidence against her. The autopsy found tiny traces of arsenic in Richard's system. At the trial in 1851, 41-year-old Sarah had no lawyer acting in her defence and wasn't allowed to give evidence. So she was swiftly found guilty by the local community in a trial that took place in a local pub and was sentenced to hang. On March 25, 1851, she was hanged at a public execution at Chelmsford Prison and became the last ever woman in England hanged for attempted murder. Over 160 years later, one of Sarah's ancestors heard about the fate of her relative and wanted to prove her innocence. Her investigation, aided by two leading barristers and using modern techniques, concluded Sarah was innocent. The amount of arsenic found in the victim's system could have been naturally occurring normal levels of arsenic found in the body, or could have come from material used back then that routinely contained small amounts of arsenic. So in essence, poor Sarah's hanging was a miscarriage of justice. Next we'll move on to ghosts, and Chelmsford seems to have more than its fair share of those. We'll start with the Spotted Dog Inn. The Spotted Dog Inn was once located on Tyndall Street, and the spot where it once stood is now a shopping centre. But that hasn't stopped the former ghosts of the inn making their presence felt. One night, a guest at the inn was murdered as he slept. After his death, his spirit reputedly kept whoever stayed in the room he was killed in awake, with incessant tapping. Eventually it got so bad that the room was sealed up. Today, shoppers and employees of the shopping centre believe the entity is still lingering and is responsible for boxes being flung about by an unseen force. That was not the only tragedy at the inn though. On October 22, 1804, a troop of Hanoverian soldiers were woken in the night to find the stables on fire, The doors to the building were closed, and they couldn't open the latch in time before they were engulfed in flames. Some were rescued, but 13 troops burned to death, and it's said their tortured spirits still haunt the area. Next up we have Highlands House, which is part of the Highland Estates, a public park set in 574 acres of historic parkland. Nowadays the house is a wedding venue, however since it was built in 1730, it has had 9 different owners and served many purposes. During World War I, the house was used as a military hospital, and during World War II, it was used by the SAS as their headquarters, as well as a German prisoner of war camp. After the war, the house was left a ruin until it was restored by the council in the 1980s, so it has quite a varied history, and it's no surprise that it is allegedly haunted by several ghosts in all different rooms. One of the more frequent sightings is that of a man wearing a Victorian hat and long coat carrying a set of keys. He has been witnessed on the first floor landing. Then moving down into the cellar, a voice has been heard saying, "Get out." In the library, an angry male spirit has been seen, who makes it clear he doesn't like strangers entering the area. In the drawing room, when the piano is being played, a young girl suddenly appears and then disappears. And in the basement, cooks have been seen, and an unknown lady in what was the toilets. Visitors and staff also report they feel like they are being watched, and there is an uncomfortable atmosphere in parts of the building. Another haunting was highlighted to us by Guy. It is Chelmsford Civic Centre. The theatre is allegedly haunted by a man that helps visitors to their seats or directs them to the toilets. When visitors ask staff about him, they are told that he is one of the building's ghosts. Footsteps have also been heard on the stage, and another apparition is that of a white butterfly that is only seen in December, during a show being performed during the week of Christmas. We'd love to know, Guy, if you've been to any of these locations, and if so, have you ever experienced anything paranormal at them? Tucson, Arizona. Tucson, Arizona is known for its stunning Sonoran Desert, amazing cuisine, and clean air. Because of its unique climate and clear skies, it is also one of America's top spots for stargazing with the naked eye. Our patron Judy is lucky enough to live there, and for you Judy, we'll first look at the baffling case of Chuck Morgan. 39-year-old Chuck Morgan from Tucson, Arizona was a successful businessman. He was also a potential witness in a state land fraud case involving a powerful crime boss. On the 22nd of March 1977, he drove his two daughters to school and then disappeared without explanation for 3 days. When he returned home, he had a plastic handcuff around one ankle. He was missing a shoe and his hands were tied together with a zip tie. He was so badly beaten he couldn't speak, but wrote down that he'd been kidnapped and tortured. However, he refused to reveal who was responsible and would not allow his wife Ruth to call the police, as he feared a hit would be put on the family. Ruth agreed to her husband's wishes and nursed him back to health. He revealed to her that he had a secret identity and that he had worked as an agent for the federal government and fought against organized crime and had managed to escape from his captors, although they still had his Treasury identification card. After the kidnapping, Chuck became understandably paranoid and began wearing a bulletproof vest and grew a beard to mask his identity. But it was all in vain, as just 2 months after his first disappearance, Chuck vanished again. There was no news about him until 9 days later, when Ruth received a strange phone call from an unknown woman who told her Chuck was alright, but she gave Ruth references to Bible passages. 2 days later, Chuck was found dead. He'd been shot in the back of the head. The gun was found beside his body. Forensics revealed no fingerprints on the gun, but gunshot residue was found on Chuck's left hand, indicating he had fired a weapon. However, it wasn't a clear-cut suicide. In Chuck's car, the police found a note, apparently written by him, directing them to the crime scene. They also found weapons, ammunition, and a CB radio, as well as a piece of one of his teeth wrapped in a handkerchief, and sunglasses that did not belong to him. But perhaps the strangest thing they found was Chuck had clipped a $2 bill inside his underwear. Written on the note were several Spanish names, along with numbered verses from the Bible, the same reference that the female caller had made to Ruth. Other cryptic clues were found, including a crude map showing roads between Tuscan and the Mexican border, apparently in areas notorious for smuggling. 2 days later, the woman who called Ruth contacted the police by phone and claimed her nickname was Green Eyes and that Chuck had shown her a briefcase containing several thousand dollars in cash that he told her was to buy himself out of a contract that had been put on his life. Later, Chuck's impounded car was broken into and the family home was ransacked by men claiming to be from the FBI. However, the FBI denied any knowledge of this. To date, the circumstances leading to Chuck's death are not truly understood, although there are those that believe he was killed because he was involved with illegal activity or was doing secret work for the government. It is known he did real estate escrow work for at least one mafia, so maybe that was his downfall. From organized crime, we move to the infamous Hotel Congress. The historic hotel, located on E. Congress Street, was built in 1918 and is best known for being the site of the capture of gangster and bank robber John Dillinger in 1934. Dillinger traveled to Tuscan to hide out after being wanted for bank robbery. He and his gang stayed at the Hotel Congress. However, on January 22, 1934, a fire broke out in the basement of the hotel and spread up to the third floor, where Dillinger and his gang were staying. The gang managed to escape the fire after being alerted by the switchboard, but after firefighters retrieved their belongings, their true identity was revealed, and Dillinger was arrested and transferred to a jail in Crown Point, Indiana. He later escaped and was eventually shot down in Chicago, Illinois. However, the Congress is not only known for Dillinger, it is also reputed to be extremely haunted. An unknown man has been spotted on several occasions, peering from a second-story window. Then there is a maid who is always cleaning, but no one knows who she is, and a man with a top hat who struts around the lobby. One notable story was revealed in 2003, when the then owner spoke about a time when a spirit came to the aid of a guest. One night, a guest asked the owner for the woman desk clerk they had just spoken to. The owner immediately knew this was one of the resident ghosts, as there was only a male desk clerk working that night. Room 214 is said to be haunted by the spirit of a guest who died from a self-inflicted shotgun wound in that room. And room 242 is said to be haunted by a female spirit who shot herself in the head during a SWAT standoff in the mid-90s. Apparently, her ghostly image has been seen in the bathroom mirror. Another spirit that resides in the building is long-term former guest Vince Zuda, who checked in during the late 1950s and stayed until he died in 2001. Vince was known to be a fix-it man, who was constantly borrowing butter knives from the restaurant. To this day, workers still find butter knives in random places all over the hotel. We'd love to know, Judy, if you've ever visited the hotel, and if so, have you experienced anything strange there? Yellowknife, Northwest Territories, Canada. Yellowknife, the capital city of the Northwest Territories, was literally built on gold. And in the 1930s and 40s, gold mines were opened all around the area, and our patron Jordan is lucky enough to call Yellowknife his home. And in keeping with the city's history, we are first going to look at a mass murder that took place in a gold mine. Giant Mine was opened in 1943 and was still producing gold more than four decades later, and for many years was the mainstay of Yellowknife's economy. But by 1992, the richest ore seams had been taken out, and the mine had become unprofitable. However, its new owners, Royal Oak, were determined to restore its profitability, but it came at the expense of the workers, with proposed pay cuts, tough working conditions, and more discipline. Understandably, the unions fought back and eventually negotiated a new contract in 1992 that tied miners' pay to fluctuations in the price of gold. However, 72% of the union memberships voted it down in favor of strike action. The dispute got ugly, and tensions increased when Royal Oak made preparations to keep the mine operating with replacement workers, something that was practically unheard of in Canadian mines, and even illegal in some provinces. Union members set up picket lines at entrances to the mine site, armed with insulting banners and placards. However, this did not deter the management, and replacement workers were still brought in from all over Canada. Things soon got violent, and on the first night, the strike union members hurled rocks at mine buildings, assaulted a security guard, burned down a shack, and knocked out a power line. Soon the mounted police got involved and brought in riot squads to calm the escalating situation, and 38 striking miners who had participated in the riots were dismissed, further fueling the anger. A fraction of striking miners, calling themselves Cambodian cowboys, took radical action by breaking into the mine and vandalizing it with spray paint and small bombs. The whole situation divided the community, especially when some of the workers crossed the picket line and went back to work, although no one could have imagined what would happen next. At 8:45 a.m. on the 18th of September 1992, a man car carrying 9 miners along the 750-foot level of the mine triggered a bomb set beside the rail line. A large explosion sent shockwaves throughout the mine and instantly killed all 9 men, scattering their remains in a horrific scene around the tunnel. 6 of the dead were union members who had crossed the picket line. As news of the death spread, all hell broke out, causing fights in the streets, threatening phone calls and vandalism. Initially it was thought the explosion was an accident, but investigations revealed it was a deliberate act and they were looking for a murderer. After a lengthy police investigation, striking miner Roger Warren confessed to the crime. He even took investigators into the mine to show them how he fixed the bomb. However, he later recanted his confession, but despite his denials, the jury found him guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced him to life in prison. For more than a decade, Warren protested his innocence, before finally admitting his guilt in 2003. In 2014, after 18 years in jail, Warren was released and died 5 years later at the age of 75. From mass murder, we move on to ghosts and the haunted Yellowknife Inn. The Quality Inn and Suites Hotel was formerly known as the Yellowknife Inn, and the building appears to have more than its fair share of paranormal anomalies. Room 300 is particularly active, and one guest had a terrifying experience in that room. He was awoken in the night to a noise coming from the bathroom. He also thought it was strange. The TV was turned off, as when he dozed off to sleep it was still on. He used the remote to turn it back on and give himself some light. He then went into the bathroom to find the tap running. He also found food on the floor by the bathtub, and sensed he was not alone in the room. However, he went back to bed and tried to sleep, only to wake up again with the feeling someone was standing at the end of his bed, who proceeded to sit on his feet. Nervously, he turned on the bedside lamp, but there was no one there. He was so freaked out, he called the front desk to ask to be moved, but was told no other rooms were available. The man decided to leave the lamp and TV on and try to get some sleep. At 4:32 a.m, he was awoken by the sound of screaming coming from the room across the hall. He could just make out the words, "Who are you? Get out." Again, he called the front desk, who said they had not heard any reports of screaming, but they would check. After putting him on hold, they came back to him and said they would send up security. At this point, the TV turned itself off again. The man decided to stick it out and tried to go back to sleep, but was unable to sleep a wink. The next morning, he checked out of his room, and as he walked to reception, he overheard the housekeepers say there was no one in the room opposite, but people had called downstairs to report screaming. At reception, the man told the lady behind the desk what happened, and to his surprise, she said he was not the first person to have experienced such things in that room. The last couple to stay there said the same thing happened to them, apart from they saw a man standing near the window, dressed in old-fashioned clothes and a miner's hat. As for the room opposite, where the screaming came from, she confirmed it was empty, even though he had been told the night before, when he asked to change rooms, that all the rooms were booked out. Jordan, we'd love to know if you ever stayed at this hotel, and if so, have you ever experienced anything paranormal? So that's it for this episode of Too Close to Home. We'd like to say a huge thank you to Shauna, Carly, Guy, Jordan, and Judy. Remember everyone, if you'd like your hometown featured on an episode of Too Close to Home, head over to Patreon for more information. Thanks for watching, and thank you to everyone who supports over on Patreon. We'll see you tomorrow for another creepy video.